So the goal tonight in this talk is to encourage you in your confidence that the Bible indeed is accurate in its account of the history of the world. In particular, I hope to make it as clear as I possibly can that a global flood cataclysm truly occurred only a few thousand years ago, a cataclysm that radically transformed the face of the earth and reduced the human population to only 8 people. Now, why is it that most people today regard the flood merely as a quaint myth instead of as an authentic part of earth history? The flood was regarded as genuine history throughout the Western world up to about 200 years ago. So what has happened to change that so dramatically? Well, in my analysis, I believe a major turning point occurred in what is called the Enlightenment in the latter decades of the 18th century in Europe. And a noteworthy individual that was part of that movement, basically that atheist movement known as the Enlightenment, is James Hutton. He was from Scotland. He's regarded as the founder of modern geology. Why? Because he introduced the ideas of uniformitarianism and deep time in his book, Theory of the Earth, in 1795. So what do I mean by uniformitarianism? Uniformitarianism. It basically means that the assumption, the outlook that present-day processes like erosion and sedimentation acting at present-day rates can legitimately be extrapolated backward in time into the indefinite past and correctly account for geologic history. Unspoken aspect of that assumption is that there have been no world-destroying catastrophes come along the way. So that was the outlook introduced by Hutton. A famous quote from this book is, "No vestige of a beginning, no prospect of an end." So as he applied this assumption of very slow and gradual processes, typically on the order of a centimeter of sedimentation per 1,000 years on average, very slow process of erosion and sedimentation over the land surface. As he projected that back into the past, he came to the conclusion that millions of years had elapsed to produce the sediment record. So I would say, as a scientist, taking what's going on now and projecting it back into the past is not a bad first guess, first approximation, but you probably ought to check whether that really works or not. And what I'm going to show you is that outlook does not work, does not account for what we see in the geological record. So he extended that process back into the past. He concluded that the past goes so far back in time, there's no vestige of when it started, no indication how long that process, those processes had been going on. And since, as an atheist in the Enlightenment, he was assuming that there's no agent outside this material world to intervene or interfere in its operation, he concluded there's no prospect of any end, that these processes should continue more or less the same way they're going on now for millions of years into the future. So that was the outlook that Hutton introduced, that outlook of uniformitarianism, and along with it a very large amount of time, which I'm calling deep time, as far as the past is concerned. Millions, if not billions, of years. So the person actually that, that basically really developed this idea and did an incredible amount of field work, geological field work, and put together the first geology textbook, as it were, is Charles Lyell. He's considered the father of modern geology. He's famous for his book, Principles of Geology, first published in 1830 and then updated in 11 subsequent editions. And the first several generations of geologists in the United States, or in Europe as well as in the United States, had that book as their primary reference text in their training. So the first several generations of geologists were deeply influenced in with these ideas, this uniformitarianism. He was zealous in his book in advocating uniformitarianism, summarized in the slogan that the present is the key to the past. So again, hopefully you grasp that concept, that outlook, that way of interpreting the geological record, that way of interpreting the Earth's past. Okay, now, Charles Lyell was a young man when he began his five-year journey, voyage around the world on the Beagle, and he took a copy of Lyell's book with him when he left in 1831. And I believe there's no question that the principles, the concepts advanced in Lyell's book, Principles of Geology, were foundational to Darwin's speculations on how life might possibly have arisen with no action on God's part, purely by natural processes. I would say that Darwinian evolution is merely a logical extension of uniformitarianism to the realm of biology, a logical application of this uniformitarian thinking and these uniformitarian assumptions to the realm of biology. So, as we look at the landscape today, 200 years after the Enlightenment, we see major strongholds raised up against the knowledge of God. 2 Corinthians 10, the Apostle Paul uses that language that Christians are to be engaged in pulling down the strongholds that have been raised up against the knowledge of God. And in this general area that I'm going to be speaking on tonight, I see five major strongholds that have been raised up against the knowledge of God in the last 200 years. And right at the center is uniformitarian geology. And these two castles in front that are basically guarding that castle, I have materialist philosophy, the view that there is nothing that's non-material. I addressed that issue this afternoon, and showing how easy it is to refute that idea. And then another castle is radioisotope dating methods. And George, a moment ago, mentioned that I was part of the Radioisotopes in the Age of the Earth team and how we found several independent lines of evidence, of radioisotope evidence, that the Earth is young, or old, however you want to phrase it, but thousands, not billions of years old. So I'm not going to have time to get into those results, but they're available online and in books and other places that if you're interested, you can go as deep as you care to go into our results. And then these other two castles, Darwinian evolution, which I'm claiming is just an application of uniformitarian thinking to biology, and then Big Bang cosmology, which I'm not speaking on here in Vancouver, but I'm going to be addressing that in Calgary on this next Thursday night. So anyway, we're involved. There's no question we're involved in spiritual warfare. that the authority of the Bible has been under withering attack over the last 200 years. Such severe attack that there's hardly anyone that's willing to hold up the Bible and say in public today that this is what God has said. This is what the Creator God of the universe has said. Why are Christians so afraid to do that? That the Bible teaches that that's our primary offensive weapon, the quoting what God Himself has said regarding, you know, all the many topics that the Bible covers. But I believe it's because of this assault, these assaults in the guise of science, these attacks on the validity of the Bible that have caused the average person to have such a low regard for the Bible in our day. So this issue of the flood is one of these major issues. And so I want to try to address that tonight. However, despite the scoffing by the skeptics over these last 200 years, the Bible itself allows no room for uncertainty that a global world-destroying flood cataclysm truly has occurred. Let's look at some of those, just a few verses out of Genesis 6 and 7. See what the Bible has to say about this event. Verse 11, chapter 6. Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence, human violence. Then God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them, mankind. And behold, I'm about to destroy them with the earth." So that implies physical destruction of the earth. "Behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish." Very strong language. Chapter 7. Verse 11, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open or were cleaved apart, and the floodgates of the sky were opened. The rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Verse 19, "The water prevailed more and more upon the earth so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered." Note how frequently the terms "all" and "every" are used in this text as to make it perfectly clear that this was not some local event. It was a global scale event. Verse 21, "All flesh that moved on the earth perished. Birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth and all mankind of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, died." Verse 23, "Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, and they were blotted out from the earth, and only Noah was left together with those that were with him in the ark. And the water prevailed on the earth 150 days. So I would say, if you take these words at face value, what they normally mean, it is speaking of a global scale cataclysm that dramatically affected the earth. So, question: what sort of physical evidence would an event as described in Genesis 7, which we just read, leave behind? First of all, would you expect there to be physical evidence from such an event? Absolutely, you would expect there to be a lot of physical evidence. So, what kind of evidence? Well, what about billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth? That's a fairly, some of you in these circles are familiar with Ken Ham, and he uses this phrase frequently to describe what you would expect if the flood really occurred. So when we examine the rock record, what do we actually find? What do we actually observe? Well, What about billions of dead things buried in sediment layers all over the earth? That's a very prominent aspect of the sediment record, that we find dramatic examples of dead things buried in these sediment layers, like starfish, ammonites, marine reptiles, as we see here. And I want to emphasize that you do not get fossils preserved unless you have rapid burial and complete burial of the organism. And to get rapid and complete burial basically requires catastrophic processes. So the occurrence of fossils, in my assessment, represents a reliable diagnostic to whether a given layer was a result of the flood or not. So one can, if you have a layer that has fossils in it, to me it's a certain indicator that layer is a product of this cataclysm. Some more. This is a plesiosaur, a large marine reptile predator in the pre-flood world, buried as a fossil. Another animal we don't have around, probably most of us are grateful that these things are not flying around today, the pterosaur. These particular ones, shown in this artist's depiction, had a wingspan of about 11 meters. And they, when they were walking around on the ground, they basically walked on their elbows of their wings, and they preyed on smaller dinosaurs. So it's some amazing fossils that we find, amazing types of life that existed in that pre-flood world. Lots of dinosaurs in the fossil record. This is a site near the Colorado-Utah border, not that far away from here, and there are several dozen large dinosaurs buried together, but there's none of them that are buried whole. Basically, you have chunks of dinosaur. You see that spinal column, just a part of it. A chunk of dinosaur was buried there. These leg bones. Basically, it appears the process that buried these dinosaurs was very violent. Ripped the dinosaurs together and buried them before there was a chance for any kind of predation or decay. And these bones are all jumbled together in this massive burial site. And there's some similar sites right here in Canada. Whole herds of dinosaurs buried together. So, as I've already said, fossilization of an organism requires rapid and complete burial, and the fossils, hence, are a reliable indicator of catastrophic conditions. Also, the fact that fossils are so common throughout the Cambrian to Cenozoic sediment record argues that this entire record is a record of catastrophe on a global scale, and that almost certainly has to correspond to the flood described in Genesis. Fossilized plants likewise testify to this global cataclysm. This is a large coal seam in the Powder River Basin. The Wyoming-Montana border straddles this formation. 40% of all the coal used in the United States comes from this single deposit. Much of it is exported. And I think some of the coal trains even come to Vancouver to be put on ships to be exported. This coal seam in many places is up to 30 meters in thickness. It's the coal is a result of trees, fossilized trees, and studying the internal structure, it's clear that these trees did not grow in place. They were transported to this location and buried, which again is speaking of incredible catastrophic conditions to be transport this huge volume of trees, of plant debris, and burying it here together. Moreover, even apart from their fossils, the sediment layers themselves testify to conditions radically different from those operating in our world today. So, most of these fossil-bearing layers are horizontally extensive for hundreds to thousands of kilometers in both directions. So they represent horizontal sediment deposits with tremendous lateral extent, different from anything. There's nothing like this being formed, no deposits like this being formed on the continents today. So right just from that basic observation, we can see that this concept of uniformitarianism is falsified, that the present is not a reliable guide to the past. This is a radical contradiction to that assumption. Moreover, the boundaries between the layers display little or no erosional channeling. In this particular figure, we see the Bryce Canyon, Zion Canyon, Grand Canyon, big erosional channels in today's Earth's surface. But as you look at the boundaries between layers, you do not see these big channels there. It appears that these layers were laid down one on top of another without any intervening erosion, as an indication that this sedimentation was continuous and rapid, producing the whole sediment column in a single large event. This contact, marked by the black arrow, is the contact between the Coconino sandstone and the Hermit shale, which underlies it, completely different types of sedimentary rock. In the Grand Canyon, you can hike down from the visitor center on the south rim of the Grand Canyon down the Bright Angel Trail and see this very spot where this photo was taken. And this is typical of the boundaries between the layers in the geological record. The flat contact between the Coconino and the Hermit formations is characteristic of the boundary between a majority of these strata. Again, indicating that the present is not the key to the past as we examine the sediment record. In addition, the internal structure of many of the layers implies catastrophic processes for the deposition of the layers themselves. The area pictured here is in the Navajo sandstone near the Utah-Arizona border and is known as the wave. And what you're looking at there is called crossbedding. It's the result of large dune structures that were formed as this sand was deposited by rapidly moving water. It formed large dunes, sand dunes, underwater sand dunes, and the light and darker colored sand represents the structure of these dunes. And periodically, the whole surface was beveled flat. The tops of the dunes were cut off, and that is seen in this image as well. The size and speed of the water currents needed to generate such large dune structures is challenging for our minds to imagine. The required rapidly moving water and carrying lots of sediment, depositing a lot of sediment very rapidly. So this is where the Navajo sandstone is in the record. It displays these giant cross beds everywhere, as well as also having vast lateral extent. These are strong indicators of high energy, high speed water transport. This is an aerial view of Zion National Park, showing cliffs that are 700 meters high. They represent the exposed edge of a gigantic sheet of sand, the Navajo sandstone, that stretched originally from Southern California to central Wyoming and from Idaho to New Mexico. Its volume is sufficient to bury the entire state of Texas to a depth of 87 meters. The sand is extremely uniform in its properties, in its, the size of the sand grains, and so on. And it's, it boggles the mind to imagine the source area for so much sand that would produce this uniform layer over so vast an area. So, let's now look at the issue of what the record can tell us about the beginning of this cataclysm. We see the evidences of cataclysm. Do we find a clear-cut point in the record where this catastrophe began? And just where might we look to find the beginning point? Well, if we're looking to fossils as a reliable indicator of sediment layers deposited during the flood, then the sudden first appearance of a wide diversity of animals likely marks the flood's beginning point. Do we find such a location in the record? And the answer is a resounding yes. The abrupt appearance of an astonishing diversity of complex animals lies just above a striking erosional boundary, or discontinuity, which is of global extent, known as the Great Unconformity. And the term Cambrian explosion, which many of you have heard of, is often applied to this point in the record. And the reason it's called an explosion, the Cambrian explosion, it's explosion of life from an evolutionist point of view. It's an explosion of sudden burial of lots of different kinds of animals from a flood point of view. In either case, we find 23 of the 27 animal phyla, that's a large, high-level categories of life that exist in the entire fossil record. If out of 27 that we find in total in the fossil record, we find 23 of those phyla present in the Cambrian rocks. So rather than a gradual emergence of more and more complex animals with time, we find just the opposite. We find at the very beginning of the record most of the diversity of life present. And right here in Canada, there's a good example, the Burgess Shale up in the Rocky Mountains up near Banff, a little place called Field. It made a huge impact on the evolutionist community back at the turn of the 20th century. To find all these animals, such a huge variety of animals, some that had never been seen before in that shale, Burgess Shale. And that's at the Great Unconformity. The erosional aspects of the Great Unconformity tell us that the flood's onset was exceedingly violent. This boulder that my hand is on is one of the boulders right above the Great Unconformity in central Wisconsin, from the Baraboo Quartzite Formation. So we have giant Baraboo Quartzite boulders atop the massive Baraboo Formation. And the Baraboo Formation, the top of it is about the level of my head there. Solid rock, solid quartzite below, and just above these gigantic boulders that have been ripped up from that quartzite formation and scattered for miles and hundreds of miles. It boggles the mind to imagine the violence that is required to rip up pieces of rock of that size and move them around. Here's another shot of some of those boulders, just adjacent to where that previous photo was shot. So that gives you an idea of what that boundary looks like. And it's not just there. You find similar cases around the world. That boundary in Arizona and Utah is observable in many locations. One is in the Grand Canyon, and here I've marked the great unconformity with that black arrow right here. And this is the great unconformity. And it's exposed right there in the inner gorge of the Grand Canyon. So I'll show some pictures of that. Before I do that, I'll just show that once you learn a little about the geology of the Grand Canyon, it's easy to see, to follow that boundary from one horizon in the canyon to the other. It's at the base of this cliff that is just below this more gradual slope known as the Bright Angel Shale, the greenish shale that you can track from one horizon to the other. There you see this cliff, this is the Tapete Sandstone, and the Great Unconformity is right at the base of that sandstone layer. You can hike down. There are several trails you can take. It takes you right through that boundary. This is Dr. John Morris. He and I were tent mates on a camping, hiking trip down into the canyon in the late 1980s. And he's sitting on the Great Unconformity right there. This is the Tapete Sandstone. You know, it's called sandstone, but note the size of these cobbles that are at the base of this layer here. Again, implying pretty extreme water catastrophism. This is that same layer. This is just not far away, also in the Grand Canyon. This is the Great Unconformity right here. And this boulder you see here marked with these green arrows is 5 meters in diameter and weighs 200 tons. So like we saw in Wisconsin, right here in this exposure in the Grand Canyon in Arizona, we likewise see evidence of extreme violence at that boundary. I want to go back. One thing let's see if I can go back. For some reason, this is not going to go back. Yeah. If you can believe it, right at that boundary, right at this very site, I found worm burrows at that boundary. So there were live critters that somehow were alive when all this was taking place. I found that quite amazing, quite interesting. All right, what about the end of the cataclysm? We've seen what the beginning of the cataclysm looks like. It's well marked in the record. Several indicators. We see the unconformity, and we see the violence associated with it. We see the abrupt appearance of complex life right at that boundary. What about the end of the cataclysm? After so vast an amount of sediment had been carried onto the continents, deposited in horizontally extensive layers, a significant fraction of that sediment was stripped away from the continent interiors and carried by runoff water to the continental shelves at the end of the flood. So the end of the flood is also well marked in the record. I use this slide to illustrate where that boundary appears in many places. The buttes and spires of Monument Valley, Utah are powerful testimony to the rapid runoff of the waters of the flood and the massive erosion that accompanied the runoff. So we see this is an indication that there has been a huge amount of erosion that didn't strip the more resistant parts of it away, left a few remnants, but stripped away thousands of feet of material that once had been deposited here. Actually, this slide indicates the amount that there's indication, there are remnants of these layers to the south, indicating that these layers once extended much further to the south, but have since been stripped away. So, and then we find these erosional channels that characterize the Earth's surface today. So, so there's also indicators of the end of the flood in the geological record. In summary, we find that a staggering amount of geological change took place during this flood cataclysm. And the Bible reveals that it all unfolded within the span of only a single year. And so then let me ask this. What then is the correct interpretation of the fossil record? This record of plants and animals we see with some a definite trend. We find mostly marine animals at the bottom. As we go up higher and higher, more and more terrestrial types of plants and animals, at the top, completely terrestrial plants and animals. Is this record a record of some 580 million years of evolution with appearance and disappearance of all these different types of animals? Or is it tangible documentation of the destruction of life by the flood during a single year? Which is it? Well, for a lot of people, it's not easy it's not easy to defend this position. But this is what the Bible would imply. So, and then there's this issue here. Some of you are surely thinking, but I've been taught all my life that the fossil record spans hundreds of millions of years. What about the radioisotope methods that consistently yield such vast ages for the Earth's rocks? Okay, I would say that reaction is almost universal today by from college-educated people. Well, this indeed is a very paramount issue. But it was addressed in a serious way by the Radioisotopes in the Age of the Earth initiative that spanned 8 years from 1997 to 2005. This research documented multiple lines of radioisotope evidence which limit the Earth's age to about 6,000 years. And some of you may be aware of some of the reports. We have a DVD, we have a 200-page book called Thousands, Not Billions, but I suspect most of you haven't availed yourself of the main technical report that we wrote, 800-page technical report. The original volume cost, I think, $70, but now it's available for free. Each chapter is a PDF file. It can be downloaded from this website. It's ICR, www.icr.org/rate2. And each chapter is a separate PDF file. And so you can download the chapter on the zircon, the helium retention in zircons, which strongly points to an age of only about 6,000 years. You can download my chapter on C14, and if you're motivated and have a little bit of technical background, you might like to look at some of these chapters. I don't have time tonight to go into it, but I contend that this is powerful evidence that the Earth is young, and it's radioisotope evidence that the Earth is young. But beyond the rate work, we now have powerful evidence from soft tissue preservation. More evidence that this cataclysm was recent. For example, well-preserved flexible blood vessels containing red blood cells in Tyrannosaurus rex dinosaur bone from a site in Montana. This was reported in Science Magazine in 2005, work by Mary Schweitzer. There's even videos on the internet showing how flexible these blood vessels are, how stretchable they were. Mary Schweitzer showing that. Plus, this is the photo of the blood cells that were in these blood vessels. It's just completely unthinkable that this is from dinosaurs that lived 65 million years ago. It's a stretch to even think that it was from 4,000 years ago, or 5,000 years ago during the flood. It's hard to imagine soft tissue being preserved even that long. Anyway, since this work was published, there have been dozens of other examples of soft tissue preservation in all kinds of different animals. So this is not just a fluke, not just a rare situation. It appears to be very common. Good preservation of soft tissue of animals buried in the flood just a few thousand years ago. So that's another strong evidence that the Earth is young and that the flood is a recent event. So a key issue with regard to the flood, if the Bible is true concerning the reality of the flood, physically, how could so much change occur in the time span of a single year? What conceivably could have been the main causal mechanism? How could that possibly have happened? I might just say that the inability of Bible-believing Christians to answer that question in a credible way in the early 1800s, I believe, allowed uniformitarianism to triumph in that day. This is not an easy question. I believe that it wasn't until the 1960s that the answer started to become evident of what could possibly have caused such a catastrophe, able to resurface the entire planet in a short period of time, in a few weeks' time. So I don't fault those Christians. There were many valiant believers known as the scriptural geologists that pointed out all this evidence of catastrophism and did their best to defend the flood. But the tide of uniformitarianism carried the day, and not enough Christians stood up, and so uniformitarianism came to prevail throughout the intellectual circles of basically the entire world. What is the answer? What are some of the clues as to the mechanism for how this could happen quickly? Well, some clues, major clues, come from the ocean bottom. Huge discovery in the 1960s. All of today's ocean crust is younger than much of the fossil-bearing sediment record on the continents. So what does that mean? What is the logical implication of that finding? Well, it means that this ocean crust that exists today had to have been formed since the onset of the flood. If that crust is younger than fossil-bearing sediments, it has to have formed since the beginning of the flood. And this realization was a realization I had in the spring of 1978, and an epiphany I had. And I had been involved in doing creation speaking for a couple of years, and I realized the profound significance of that. And basically it led me to leave the staff of Campus Crusade, with which I was serving at that point, and go to UCLA, enroll in a graduate program at UCLA in earth science. And at that point, I had not had a single course in earth science. All my training had been in electrical engineering, but I felt God's call to get the training and the credentials to work on this issue at a professional level. So anyway, I realized the profound significance of that observation data. Now, just to give you an idea of where that falls in this record, I'm using this same the same picture here. And this is the Kaibab limestone at the rim of the Grand Canyon. And this marks the point where below this part of the record, below that point in the record, there is no ocean floor on Earth that has an age in this range. All of the ocean floor on Earth is younger than this point in the fossil record. And so that means all of ocean crust on Earth today has formed since this point in the record. Means that all of it today's basaltic ocean crust is formed since the onset of the flood. A very, very significant piece of observational evidence. This implies that the opening of the entire Atlantic Ocean occurred during the flood, and that also that continents migrated by thousands of miles or thousands of kilometers in only a few months' time. That's logically demanded by these observations, that large-scale continental movement took place during the flood, and that 70% of the ocean surface has come into existence by new seafloor production since that point in the flood. And you know, a lot of Christians, it's hard for that to really sink in, that's reality. That's logically demanded by these observations. So what does that imply about the pre-flood ocean floor? Well, it's missing. In other words, it means that pre-flood ocean floor is gone, missing from the Earth's surface today. And taking cues from today's ocean floor, where we find that the plates are plunging into the inside of the Earth, taking cues from that fact, that what we see going on today implies that where that pre-flood ocean floor is that it was recycled into the Earth's interior during the flood. So that is implying that the flood cataclysm not only was a hydraulic cataclysm involving water and rapidly moving water that was carrying lots of sediment, not only was it a hydraulic cataclysm, it was also a tectonic cataclysm. The conclusion that rapid large-scale tectonic change must have been a fundamental aspect of the Genesis flood has come to be known, identified with the words catastrophic plate tectonics. So this understanding of the flood has come to be known as catastrophic plate tectonics. This idea was presented in 1986 at the first International Conference on Creationism in Pittsburgh for the first time. Such large-scale tectonic change in the Earth's surface implies that the Earth's interior also was involved. So not only is the surface affected by the flood, Earth's surface, but the Earth's interior was profoundly affected as well. So with that in view, let's get some picture idea of what the inside of the Earth is like. You can basically divide the Earth into two major regions, the core and the mantle. The core is mostly molten iron. We know it's molten by seismology. There are two types of seismic waves, of body waves inside the Earth. There are compressional waves, where the material where the waves move along with compression and rarefaction. And then there are shear waves, where the material waves are propagating in a shearing kind of motion as they propagate. It turns out that a liquid won't support shear waves. And so early on, in the early 20th century, as the seismologists were studying their seismograms, they noticed that the seismic waves that went through the core, the shear waves disappeared. So it was quickly infer that the core must be molten. And further studies indicate that it has a very low viscosity, viscosity similar to that of water. So the outer core, most of the core, is made of a molten, a liquid, liquid, and other properties we infer from its density. We can infer its density, and it has a density consistent with it being molten iron, mostly molten iron. There's a small solid inner core, understood to be solid iron, or mostly solid iron, maybe a little bit of nickel, which has properties very similar to iron. But then above the core, roughly the outer half of the diameter of the Earth, not quite half, a little less than half the diameter, is mostly solid silicate rock. If we were to see it at the surface, it would be a dark, heavy type of rock. And the uppermost part of the mantle is a layer called the lithosphere. And that lithos is the Greek word for rock. And it's because of its low temperature, it behaves as a rigid solid, as a brittle solid. And so this layer is mechanically strong and basically is broken up into about a dozen plates. And then just right underneath that rigid layer at the surface, which is on the order of 50 to 100 kilometers in thickness, beneath that rigid layer is what is called the asthenosphere. And that rock is dramatically weaker than the lithosphere, roughly 1,000 times weaker than the lithosphere. So that allows the plates to slide, to move across the Earth's surface with very little drag on the bottom because of this very weak layer. And there are two reasons why that layer is weak. One is that the temperature is not that far from the melting temperature of rock. And secondly, there's evidence that there is a significant level of water, perhaps like 1% water, in the internal mineral structure of the rock, which causes those minerals to be much weaker. So anyway, this is a quick idea of what the inside of the Earth looks like. We find plates pulling apart along what are called mid-ocean ridges. This is the mid-Atlantic ridge shown here between South America and Africa. Other places, the plates are actually plunging down into the mantle at an ocean trench, as shown here. So that's a quick introduction to the internal structure of the Earth. Now this is a little more detail where these plates are plunging into the Earth. So this is the lithosphere, roughly 100 kilometers in thickness. The top 6 or 7 kilometers are basalt, black basalt, and that's called the oceanic crust. Its chemistry is slightly different from the mantle and the lithosphere. Where two plates are moving past one another is where we typically have where most of the earthquakes on Earth are generated. Usually when the plates are like this, the two plates are locked. They're rigidly locked. And they're locked until the stress builds up to the point where it becomes unlocked and you have an earthquake. And so the question came up this afternoon about the seismic risk here in Vancouver. Asking if I thought that was real or not. And as a geophysicist, I have to say yes. That's the condition. That's what's going on. The plates, the Juan de Fuca plate is locked relative to the North American plate beneath Western Washington and under this part of British Columbia. And each year, there's motion. There's the sinking of this lithosphere, and the stress is building up, steadily building up along.
along this zone.
Until it reaches a point where it can't maintain that such high stress levels, and there is a big slip event. So I see some frowns on people's faces. Sorry to be a bearer of bad news, but you know, it hasn't happened here for several hundred years, so you know, maybe y'all, most of you will not have to worry about it. You don't have to. You won't experience it. Whether you worry about it is up to you. So this is what it looks like, and because there is water carried down by this plate, water reduces the melting temperature. So when this plate gets down far enough, the water comes out of the rock. It penetrates the overlying rock, which is hot, and there's partial melting, and you get volcanoes in this region. So this corresponds to the Ring of Fire, the volcanoes all around the Pacific Ocean, where there are trenches, where there's subduction going on. Okay, I think I've covered that aspect of the Earth. So we have... So then there are places where the plates are pulling apart. And this is called a mid-ocean ridge. Mid-ocean ridge where the plates are pulling apart. Often there are offsets. The ridge has got jumps in it. Typically it's not just a continuous straight line or wavy line. The mechanics of it result in straight line segments offset by these right angle faults. And there's high heat flow along these regions, and actually even what are called black smokers, chimneys where hot water is coming out, sometimes maybe 200, 300 degrees centigrade, carrying lots of minerals out. Most of the mantle, almost everywhere, is solid. Contrary to what a lot of people somehow picked up, there's only little pockets where there's melting. And even there, it's only partial melting. And one of these places is where these plates are pulling apart. There is what's called decompression melting. A rock that had been under much higher pressure rises, finds itself under lower pressure. These minerals, some of them above their melting temperatures, and they partially melt, producing basaltic magma that forms this ocean crust that's typically about 7 kilometers thick. So this is what happens where plates are pulling apart. Typically this region is cooled by lots of water, ocean water circulating through this area and cooling the rock, causing that basalt to freeze, become solid, and form new ocean crust. So, what is the difference between catastrophic plate tectonics and conventional plate tectonics? Well, catastrophic plate tectonics is similar to conventional plate tectonics, which many of you have seen on television, or even some of you had in school, except that the plate velocities are significantly different. They're about a billion times higher in the case of catastrophic plate tectonics, on the order of 8 kilometers per hour instead of about 5 centimeters per year. There's about a billion times difference. But even 8 kilometers per hour is not that dramatic. It's pretty dramatic to have a big slab of rock moving at that speed, but it's at least conceivable with our human minds. But how is such a thing possible? Well, laboratory experiments show that mantle rock weakens dramatically when it's under stress. And it weakens dramatically at stress levels that can't exist in the Earth, in a planet the size of the Earth, with the Earth's gravity field. This weakening then provides the potential for one runaway catastrophe, because as the rock weakens, the rates of deformation increase, which causes the increase in stress, reduction in strength, increase in velocity, and that can then just result in a runaway situation. So another, I'll go back to that in a moment, but just how much continental motion are we talking about? I've already given you a little idea that the entire Atlantic Ocean opened up during the flood. But the following images summarize just how much the continents must have moved since roughly halfway in the flood when the supercontinent Pangaea existed. So this is about halfway into the flood. I'm not going to show you something similar was going on prior to this point. I'm not going to take time to go through that. But let's just start with Pangaea. Roughly when you first start to find dinosaurs in the fossil record. So we see the Pangaea breaking apart like this, and Ice Age, and then today, I can back that up and go back here, and then forward again. So we see a dramatic change, a dramatic motion of the continents by as a result of processes unfolding in the Earth's interior. So that's what I want to focus on, those processes. And if fossils are indicative of the flood, all the plate motion shown in the preceding sequence must have accompanied the flood, because that's when all that motion took place, when the fossil record was being produced. So if it's according to the biblical time frame, all this must have unfolded in a span of a few months' time. So catastrophic plate tectonics, like conventional tectonics, plate tectonics accounts for many of the Earth's physical features. We've already seen the mid-ocean ridges, the deep ocean trenches. I'll show you in a moment the global distribution of earthquakes, the volcanism, the distribution of volcanism adjacent to the trenches. These are the location of the earthquakes. All the earthquakes of magnitudes greater than 4.5 that occurred between 1980 and 1995 are shown here. We see the earthquakes concentrated where there's subduction of ocean crust. This is along the Aleutian Chain. These are the subduction zones in the Western Pacific. Beneath Indonesia here, the Java Trench, and so on. So we see, then there are a few earthquakes along the mid-ocean ridge system. And then where there's a lot of high mountains today, which are the product of the flood and a lot of tectonic change, we also find earthquakes on them. In regard to volcanism, both conventional plate tectonics and catastrophic plate tectonics, you would expect volcanism, again, associated with subduction along the western margin of South America, Central America, Aleutians, Western Pacific. So this is known as the Pacific Ring of Fire. So both models explain that. But what are some geological processes that are distinctive, unique to catastrophic plate tectonics that you do not expect if conventional plate tectonics has always prevailed? Well, one distinctive aspect are supersonic steam jets emerging from the seafloor along 60,000 kilometers of rapidly spreading mid-ocean rift zones. And then intense global rain from entrained ocean water lofted above the Earth by these steam jets. So this is an attempt to depict that with very rapidly spreading seafloor, in other words, kilometers per hour as opposed to centimeters per year, you're going to have a huge amount of molten rock in direct contact with the ocean water, which will result in the formation of what's called supercritical water, which almost instantly will flash to steam and produce supersonic steam jets that come ripping up through the kilometer or so of ocean water, entraining liquid water in the fringes of these jets, and carrying that water high into the stratosphere, and that liquid water then falling back to Earth as torrential rain over much of the Earth. So that's one aspect of a prediction of catastrophic plate tectonics. Another prediction is giant tsunamis as the rapidly subducting ocean plates temporarily stick and then release via large earthquakes. Earthquakes bigger than what we see today typically, and more frequent, certainly more frequent. Then we have significant up and down motions of the Earth's surface because of the flow inside the Earth, the rapid flow that's going on inside the Earth. Next, a dramatic uplift of today's mountain belts at the end of the cataclysm, where regions where the Earth's continental crust has been thickened, especially along subduction zones, that this thickened, buoyant continental crust bobs up like a cork and produces a chain of high mountains. And finally, because of the warming of the oceans during the flood, there's a logical expectation of an ice age, and I'll explain a little more why that's the case after the flood. So here is a photo of the Chilean Andes. The subduction along western South America thickened the buoyant continental crust all along that margin, and at the end of the cataclysm, that thickened crust bobbed up because of its buoyancy, like a cork bobs up, and produced the Andean mountain chain, as well as the Rockies, as well as the Himalayas, the Andes, the Alps, as a result of the similar processes. The warming of the oceans during the flood led to high rates of evaporation, precipitation, and rapid buildup of polar ice sheets and mountain glaciers in the centuries following the flood. So this moist air, due to higher evaporation rates after the flood, brought this moisture-laden air to the high latitudes, where it precipitated as a large amount of snow in the winter, and more snow in the winter that could melt in the summer, and a rapid buildup of ice sheets. So we have it's natural. You expect an ice age after the flood, but one that a single ice age that spanned only a few centuries, maybe 300 years. Roughly till the time of Abraham, roughly, we expect. So a crucial issue in all this is, how can ocean plate actually sink vertically through 2,900 kilometers of mantle lock in a few weeks' time? A very critical scientific question to understanding of the flood is valid. It requires somehow a mechanism that allows rock to sink that fast down through the mantle. So again, I've shown this photo before, but what we're talking about is ocean plate being able to subduct and sink down to the bottom of the mantle at meters per second instead of centimeters per year. And the way what I'm going to show is the mechanism that allows that to happen is the fact that mantle rock weakens under stress. And actually, that reality has been demonstrated in laboratories around the world for the last 50 years. Experiments apparatus like this one happens to be in a laboratory in Paris from about 40 years ago. You have a sample in the middle of this cylinder. This cylinder is referred to as an oven, very able to control the temperature very accurately. And then stress is applied to the sample through these aluminum rods. Very carefully controlled amount of pressure is applied to these rods. And that squeezes the sample in the middle. And they can measure the rate at which that sample deforms at a given temperature. So they revisit varying temperatures, measure the deformation rate of the sample in that type of experiment. And then at the end of the experiment, they can take that mineral sample out and look at, examine it under an electron microscope and look at the deformation that's occurred. And very often what they see are is a pattern like this. These represent individual planes of atoms that have slid over one another. As the crystal has sheared, the deformation occurs as planes of atoms like cards in a deck of cards as they slide past one another. And this can actually happen simultaneously in two directions and produce a pattern like this. But these kinds of careful experiments have been done for decades, and the rates of deformation have been carefully studied, and it's possible to come up with mathematical representation of those of that deformational data. And so, back in the 90s, I was able to put that actual deformation data into a computer code and model the deformation and actually demonstrate this runaway behavior using that actual data. And so this is a little, fairly simple, two-dimensional calculation. The color denotes temperature, blue is cold, red is hot, the arrows denote velocity, the height of the box is 2,900 kilometers. I'm trying to model the material properties as accurate as I can. So starting with the blob, cold blob at the top, hot blob at the bottom, I turn it loose, let it run, and lo and behold, it quickly goes into the runaway regime. Here we have a peak velocity of 3.6 meters per second. When the cold material gets to the bottom, hot material gets close to the top, the velocities start to fall. That was after 15 days. This is after 40 days. So the velocity is down to 1 meter per second. And here is the animation of that. This may not seem all that complex or impressive, but I was the only person in the world that had a computer code that could handle such extreme deformation rates. Some of my colleagues came close confirmed that, yes, indeed, this tendency is real. But even though it looks fairly simple, it does demonstrate that the physics works, specifically that stress weakening in rocks can produce catastrophic consequences in a planet with a gravity field of the Earth. Now, for my PhD thesis, I developed a 3D computer program for modeling flow inside the Earth's mantle. I represented the mantle as a spherical shell of rock, and used a grid like this one, the cutaway view of the spherical shell grid. I divide it up into lots of tiny cells, solve the conservation equations for mass and energy, and impose a force balance on each cell, causing the forces to balance in each cell. This particular grid I'm showing has 32 layers in the radial direction, and about 1.35 million cells. So I'm able, using the supercomputer, to solve all those equations. I have, for some of you that may remember a little of your algebra from high school, you may recall solving two equations with two unknowns. And solving for the two unknowns. Well, this problem, and then for this grid, I have four unknowns for each cell. I have 1.35 million cells, so that corresponds to a little more than five million unknowns. So I have 5 million equations, 5 million unknowns that I'm trying to solve simultaneously. And so a mathematician at Los Alamos, where I did this work, kind of method for doing that much more efficiently than anyone had done before, and made this kind of calculation feasible. And so when I entered UCLA, I wondered, how in the world can I do a thesis that these secular people will accept, that also would relate to my desire to model a flood? Well, God basically handed it to me on a silver platter, brought me in contact with this mathematician at Los Alamos, opened up the opportunity to have access to the computers there to do my graduate research work there, and enabled me to working with this mathematician, put this computer program together, which is now known as Terra. And at that time, they said that kind of calculation was at least 10 years away. The computers would not be powerful enough to solve systems of equations like that for another 10 years. But with this mathematician's technique, it enabled me to do so. It turned out that the combination of the Cray computers in Los Alamos with this method, the numerical method, would give me more benefit than the Cray supercomputer. But the combination allowed me to do it, and my graduate committee at UCLA was just dumbfounded that anybody could accomplish that. So I they were excited that it was done at UCLA, and so they had no hesitation in giving me a PhD. So I thank God. It was an example of God, even though I had some little. Actually quite a bit of uncertainty. Was God really leading me to undertake this PhD in earth science? Well, he opened incredible doors to me so that I could no longer have any question that he indeed called me to this. So, anyway, that's the grid that I used, and this is an example of a calculation where I apply that model to try to model the breakup of Pangaea during this flood cataclysm. So this shows the initial condition that I use in this particular calculation. I've taken the present day continents, and those are just for reference. Our present day continents are outlined here, and I take those continents, put them together in a Pangean-like configuration. To get the calculation going, I put some coal material down to a depth of 400 kilometers around the perimeter of this supercontinent, plus some out here. I found that was important as a result to get this calculation going. And this is a slice through the equator showing this coal material, which is 400 degrees colder than the surrounding rock, extending down 400 kilometers. So that's the only perturbation, the only thing that's different from a uniform temperature throughout this mantle initially. But with that slight perturbation, that's enough to get motions going and to cause this runaway to unfold. So this is an animation starting from that initial condition, and it shows how that initial condition allows these blocks to pull apart from one another, and the blocks basically to move in the right directions. This block to move toward where North America is located, this one toward where South America today is located, Africa moving toward where it's located, India, Australia, Antarctica. These don't are a little slow, but anyway, the general directions are pretty good, given the simplicity of that initial condition. This is a slice through the equator showing the development, that coal material sinking, plunging to the bottom, hot material being pushed away from the bottom, swept, and some of it coming up where the plates are actually pulling apart. This is a view of that same calculation from the North Pole. Velocities on the order of, basically, the surface velocity is on the order of 1 to 2 meters per second. And this is at a time of 125 days. after this calculation starts. This is a view from the South Pole. And again, it's a somewhat crude calculation, but it demonstrates the idea that this kind of motion actually unfolds, and that kind of in using the viscosities from the 2D calculation, it shows that it can unfold in a few weeks' time. Well, that's a good question. How do I justify that initial condition? I believe it's likely that God created it that way during creation with the potential for this kind of catastrophe. It wasn't guaranteed that it would happen, but I believe when Adam fell and Adam sinned, it's likely that the earth started moving toward that state of affairs where that would run away. So that's, you may or may not like that, but that's about the only way I can imagine that could have come about. It was part of the initial creation.
Did meteorites came here?
No, I do not believe so. That meteorites would not produce a pattern that would lead to that kind of breakup of Pangaea.
And we don't seem to have anything to do with Mars, water above the atmosphere.
No, I do not believe the mechanical idea, and we can go into that in question time as to why. First of all, some numerical experiments at ICR by Ioannidis showed that you can't have more than about 6 inches of liquid water in the form of vapor in the atmosphere without having a runaway greenhouse effect. Water vapor is a very strong greenhouse gas, and 6 inches of water is not going to make any difference in the flood. Okay. I'm not saying that there wasn't a significant difference in the atmosphere. There may well have been some more greenhouse gas in the atmosphere before the flood than there is today, but I don't believe the canopy idea is viable for many different climates. Okay, is there any evidence supporting a recent episode of catastrophic plate tectonics? I would say if an event like this, catastrophic plate tectonics, happened, you might well expect some evidence for it. And sure enough, there is, in my opinion, very clear evidence for it. Seismic images of the mantle reveal a ring of unexpectedly cold rock at the bottom of the mantle, beneath the subduction zones that surround the Pacific Ocean. And this is a result of what is called seismic tomography, using tens of thousands of earthquakes as detected at thousands of seismic stations, processing all that data to get an image of the structure of the inside of the Earth. These cold regions you see here, these blue regions, represent cold rock just above the core mantle boundary, at the bottom of the mantle. And this is a view from the Western Hemisphere. This is Japan, Korea, Japan. This is the Western Pacific. This is the Eastern Pacific. This is North America and South America. So we see beneath the subduction zones around the Pacific this ring of cold material, the same ring you see viewed from the Eastern Hemisphere. But in the middle of this ring, on both sides of the Earth, you find this red material, which is low-density material, presumably because of its high temperature. And from the densities, you can infer a temperature difference of about 3,000 degrees centigrade between the cold material and the hot material, which implies that cold material is near the temperature of lithosphere at the Earth's surface today, which means that material at the bottom, its temperature is not increased significantly from when it was at the surface. It is now at the bottom. Now, this is in violent conflict with the standard secular interpretation that it takes about 100 million years for a plate to sink through the mantle from the top down to the bottom. And in 100 million years, that temperature difference disappears. So by the time the rock gets down to the bottom, it's not far from the temperature of the surrounding rock. So this finding, this cold material at the bottom mantle, was a major surprise to the earth science community, especially through the decade of the 1990s. And they've gone through all kinds of gyrations to try to explain it. And I would say it's still no satisfactory explanation. So in my view, this is very strong evidence for a recent episode of catastrophic plate tectonics. And so I haven't said up to now what the energy source that would drive catastrophic plate tectonics is. Well, it's simply the gravitational potential energy of the cold material at the top and the hot material originally at the bottom. That cold material has a natural tendency to sink. And when it sinks, its gravitational potential energy is converted into mechanical energy, which is then converted into heat. And similarly, this buoyant material at the bottom initially has gravitational potential energy, wants to rise, but once it's risen to the top, it has given up its potential energy. So it's potential energy that drives this process, and you can show that there's plenty of energy to produce this catastrophe in the form of gravitational potential energy. So there's no external energy needed to drive this process. But there's a major question I've not yet touched on, and that is, how were the continents flooded? We have evidence in the scripture that the continents were flooded. And how was this sediment record, thousands of feet of sediment with all its fossils, how was that record produced? So it's only been recently that I have addressed that question. And actually, I published a paper this last February in the Answers Research Journal. It's hosted by Answers in Genesis. And I'll give that reference in a moment. I'm going to summarize the results of that paper here. And basically, the mechanism for producing the sediment record and flooding the continents is a result of the tsunamis. It's a consequence of the tsunamis that are generated by catastrophic plate tectonics. And as I've already mentioned, the tsunami, these earthquakes occur when the plates stick, when the subducting plate is locked relative to the, say, adjacent continental plate. And there is stress that builds up because of this locking condition. So this red is representing stress in these images. So as this locking takes place, as time goes on, this is sinking. This plate is deforming. So it's being this is being pulled down. This is being pushed up as this region is being elastically deformed by this sinking plate. So we have here as it proceeds. This plate is being deformed pretty extremely compared to the starting condition here. And eventually, these rocks can't sustain the kinds of stress that have built up. And so there's a slip. This fault breaks. There's rapid slip. This plate is restored to its original shape, like you see here. That pushes, that sudden release, elastic release, pushes all this water up, and that becomes a gigantic tsunami, a gigantic tidal wave that comes crashing into the land. So that's basically how a tsunami is produced, and with plates moving at roughly 8 kilometers per hour, and sticking most of the time, except for brief episodes when they unlock and slip. You have frequent tsunamis. So in the model I'm going to show you, I have the major subduction zones undergoing walking and slipping. And then I have I have them locked for 4 hours, I think. I have 16 different zones, and I have a major earthquake somewhere along those zones every 4 minutes. So we're having gigantic tsunamis produced very rapidly during this episode of catastrophic plate tectonics. So here, I'm going to show you just a simple example case. I have a large supercontinent, circular in shape, that's just to the left of this line. So we're looking basically 90 degrees to the center of the continent in this view. Along this line, I'm having the subduction take place and the generation of these tsunamis. And the colors denote the height of the water. So blue means 400 meter pressure of the surface. This red is a 600 meter elevation of the surface. So we see these tsunamis that are going off every 4 minutes and producing a wave. They tend to sort of reinforce one another and produce these more or less coherent waves that are moving toward the continent. This is after 5 hours, this is after 10 hours. So at this point, these tsunamis are starting to impinge onto the continent. And basically, what I find is that there's more water in place on the continent than can bring off by gravity initially. So the water level over the continents is continually rising as this is going on until an equilibrium is reached where the water height is great enough for that water to bring off at the same rate that it's being placed, bring off by gravity, at the same rate it's being placed by the tsunamis. But by that time, you've got well over a kilometer average water depth over the continent. So this is a way of explaining the flooding of the continents, very straightforward way in terms of what one would expect in this regime of catastrophic plate tectonics. In addition, what's going on, the Earth is rotating once a day. And there's a Coriolis, what's known as the Coriolis effect, Coriolis force that operates because of the Earth's rotation. It causes the water to rotate. And so we have a anticyclonic gyre, a large cell of rotating water start to develop. This is after 2.5 days, and this is 5 days. Let's just focus on after 5 days. So we have this rotating, clockwise rotating feature in the northern hemisphere, opposite direction in the southern hemisphere. And then in the ocean regions, we have counterclockwise rotations. In the atmosphere, these would correspond to high pressure regions and low pressure regions. And the same equations that govern the atmosphere apply here. So we have the same fluid behavior as in these ocean currents as we have in the atmosphere as far as flow patterns and the effect of the Coriolis force. All right, so let's look at what happens later in time. I'm going to look at a time after 100 days. And so here, by 100 days, we have the water height 1,500 meters above the original sea level, a huge stack of water up in the high latitudes of these continents. Okay. These colors denote sea level height. Okay? So I'm gonna not talk much about this bottom frame is the height above the land surface. And it's similar to this, but it's relative to the height of the land beneath, including the sediment that's been deposited. These areas that are dark blue correspond to regions below sea level, reflecting regions of heavy erosion. These tsunamis allow that to produce erosion. They have an erosion model in there, use cavitation as the erosion mechanism. So these tsunamis slamming into the continent margin are generating new sediment, producing sediment that is being suspended by this rapidly moving water. So it's not only a water showing motion, that monolith tracks the motion of the water, but it also generates sediment and transports the sediment. So it's a relatively complicated treatment of this. Now these pictures, again, I'm just going to focus on the 100 days. This show is the accumulated bedrock erosion. So here, red is 1,200 meters of erosion. So there's been deep erosion going on. There's heavy erosion around the margin of the continent, but then in these equatorial regions, pretty extreme erosion. So there's enough erosion there to produce about a kilometer worth of sediment on top of the continents. So let's look at how much sediment is in suspension. Here, red denotes 100 meters of solid equivalent sediment in this water column, suspended in the water column. So just a staggering amount of sediment in suspension by this very rapidly moving water, which then is getting spread out over the continent's surface. And this is the cumulative deposition. This is how much sediment has been deposited. So there are places the sediment gets, when the water velocity gets small, the sediment falls out. And then if the velocities go high again, that sediment can be re-eroded, resuspended, and deposited elsewhere. So this is the pattern of sediment deposition after 100 days, and there are places where there's been 3 kilometers worth of sediment deposited. Staggering, and corresponding to some of the kinds of thicknesses that we see today on the continents. And the velocities, I forgot to mention those. I've limited the velocities. We have peak velocities higher. Here, the biggest arrow corresponds to 30 meters per second, which is a high velocity for water. And this last one has to do with the resulting topographic height of the surface. And here, we have the surface level increased by 1.5 kilometers. Now, to allow this calculation to be stable, I had to put in what was called some isostatic compensation. In other words, when this sediment depth got large, in order for this calculation to be stable, I had to allow the length, that heavy weight, to push the original surface down. And so, so the reason that we're not seeing surface heights 3 kilometers higher is that I've allowed some of this compensation to take effect. And for that great thickness of sediment to actually push the surface down. So this is just the paper I published goes into a lot more detail than this. It's online on the Answers in Genesis website under Answers Research Journal. It's February 2016, a paper entitled "The Miracle Modeling of the Large-Scale Erosion, Sediment Transport, and Depositional Processes of the Genesis Flood." So, if some of you are interested, that's I'm giving you just a quick glimpse, quick summary of that work. So I'm excited about finally having at least a beginning idea of beginning answers to questions, basic questions like, where did the water come from to flood the continents? How was that all of a sudden produced? How was it transported? What caused it to be deposited in the pattern that we see? And then why did all the flood waters run off? And basically, when the plate tectonics shuts down, the tsunami shut down, the water velocities tending to put the water up on the continents, that goes away and the water begins to drain off. So there's pretty obvious answers to those questions in this framework. So what are the takeaway points from what we've looked at? Well, one is that the Bible is emphatically clear about the reality of a catastrophic flood. I don't think anybody will argue with that. The second is that physical evidence for the flood is abundant and readily observable. I spent almost the first half of the talk going through the evidence for the flood, which is, you know, there's all over the place. So a Christian should have no apology for the fact that there's evidence for the flood. The reality of the flood, I believe, now is rationally defensible, a rationally defensible proposition. I believe we have at least a beginning idea of what some of the main mechanisms are. So not only do we have biblical support for the flood, not only do we have observational evidence that the flood really happened, but we have a good start on ideas of what was responsible, what were the primary mechanisms that were operating. And finally, I'm convinced that defending the flood is essential to upholding the Bible's truthfulness in today's intellectual climate. I believe that most of the erosion of biblical authority can be traced to a lack of ability to defend the flood in over the last 200 years. So I believe if we're going to defend the authority of the Bible, a major point we have to start defending is the reality of the flood. So it's interesting that the Apostle Peter prophesied the state of affairs that we're in today, almost 2,000 years ago. In 2 Peter 3, Peter writes, "Know this first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming, of Christ's coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation." So Peter's saying that sometime in the future, from when he wrote in the first century, there'd be people, scoffers coming along, mocking the claim that Jesus was going to return. And their excuse was, for ever since the fathers fell asleep, you know, ever since, as long as far back as we can know, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. That sounds a lot like the present is the key to the past. All continues just as it always has been. So here Peter is prophesying, predicting the rise of uniformitarianism. So what is Peter's response to that argument? What is his response? He says, when the people, these mockers, come, they are being willfully ignorant of this fact, that by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which water the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. So they're being willfully ignorant in regard to, as far as uniformitarianism, willfully ignorant that God acted supernaturally during creation, in the creation of the heavens and the earth. God acted supernaturally, and again, a second time, he acted supernaturally at the time of the flood, when the earth was being destroyed, being flooded with water. So I believe Peter prophesies that the times that we're living in, what would happen, and that prophecy has come true. And so I believe that as the, if you will, the believing remnant today, we need to be ready to defend the flood for anyone who will listen and pay attention. But at least we need to have our heads on straight concerning the flood and not be intimidated by these mockers any longer. That's my outlook. It's interesting that Noah, it's not surprising that he's listed in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11. Verse 6, it says, without faith it is impossible to please God, to please Him. For he that comes to God must believe that he exists and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And then the next verse, by faith, he starts to list these people of faith. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So I believe Noah's faithfulness serves as an example for us. And Noah's example ought to motivate us to be faithful. Faithful in communicating the truth that also in a passage that deals with the flood, that Jesus died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God. What a joyful privilege we have to be able to tell others how they, as a free gift, by faith in Christ, can have complete pardon of sin, be brought into right standing with God, possess eternal life, and escape a judgment like the judgment that took place in the days of Noah. So it's interesting that the mention of Noah in the New Testament basically is in the context of Christ's second coming and in the context of a coming judgment. So in any case, I believe the issue of the flood should encourage us to emulate Noah and seek to be faithful in our generation as Noah was faithful.